Case number 12-1382, Public Service Electric and Gas Company et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Shepard for the petitioners, Ms. Perry for the respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. FERC's orders below inflicted a fundamental and evulsive change on transmission planning within the PJM transmission service area by holding that PJM's very governing documents, the agreements between PJM's members and PJM itself, somehow allows non-utility would-be transmission owners to build new transmission projects within the franchise service zones of existing utilities, and moreover, to charge those utilities' customers cost-based rates for those new facilities. As a matter of contract interpretation, FERC's interpretation is specious and fails at Chevron Step 1. In addition, its result goes beyond FERC's jurisdiction, as FERC is purporting to decide who gets to build transmission facilities, which is something the Federal Power Act simply does not allow it to do. Before proceeding to the merits, I need to deal first with FERC's ever-present claims of lack of standing and rightness. FERC contends that transmission owners here lack standing because non-incumbent utilities have yet to build a cost-based project in one of their zones. We dealt with this at considerable length in the reply brief, and I'm merely covering this terrain for the purpose of due caution about losing on a jurisdictional basis. Before last month, I would have suggested that this court should turn to Judge Randolph's decision in Idaho Power as the case most on point for why FERC's theory of standing and rightness is wrong. However, just last month on December 3rd in Southwest Power Pool, this court decided a case that speaks very directly to the issues presented here. This is a contract rights case. FERC decided the contract rights case against us. And what this court said last month is as follows. We have held that an agency interpretation that defines contractual rights and obligations may itself create enough of an injury to confer standing on a party to that contract, citing Dominion Transportation Incorporated versus FERC, and noting that FERC's decision cast a very present shadow over the RTO membership negotiations at issue there. So to here, what did FERC do? FERC first created a new hybrid species of transmission entity, which heretofore not only not existed in PJM, but anywhere else in the United States. And in addition, it created this new theory of project sponsorship, which is in addition spawned an entirely new form of litigation over whether or not I sponsored this first or you sponsored this first and how much the project that was approved looks like the project that is the one that I approved. And there's already been litigation about that by a follow-up case by Primary Power that's discussed in the pleadings. Is this case ripe for review? Of course. FERC's position could not be more fully crystallized. They've issued four orders in two different proceedings, all of them declaring our rights adversely the very same way. It is a purely legal question, and if we were to wait until the trigger point that FERC suggests, we would, of course, be presented with the suggestion that we were bringing a collateral attack on this body of orders that are challenged in this proceeding here.
Why do you say that? Why do you think you'd, of course, be confronted with that?
Well, this is the case that decided that entities are allowed to – that non-utility putative transmission owners are allowed to invade utilities' territory and build these new projects. If we were to wait until the case where they were actually allowed to do that through the procedures in PJM, then we would be told that this original case was the one where we should have had the fight.
It's no. How do you know that? I guess I'm just confused. How would you know that you'd be told that? Has that happened before
in a parallel situation? Oh, sure. It's happened quite a number of times. I think the best, most recent case in this subject would be Sacramento Municipal Utility District. But there are a long line of cases I'd be happy to list on reply if that's important to you, dealing with collateral attacks on FERC orders. This is our only opportunity because of the way that Section 313 of the Federal Power Act is written to attack an order that finally adjudicates our rights. We can never do so again.
Can I ask a question about the primary power one? I know that we have two cases before us.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the primary power one, so as to that one, the choice has already been made that it's not going to be primary power and it's going to be an existing transmission?
Primary power proposed four projects, synchronous condenser projects, two projects similar to two of the four that primary power proposed were built by two separate utilities. There was then litigation about primary power saying, well, hey, we're the ones who came up with that idea, you should pay us for that idea, and that litigation has already been resolved.
And so is there a mootness issue with respect to that one? Because
no, but primary power could walk in tomorrow and say it wants to build something else.
Okay, so it's the same argument as it gets back to the same point.
Right. This, and Central Transmission, of course, tried to intervene in this case. There were their lawyer's in the process of shifting from one law firm to another, so they accidentally failed a month late, filed their motion to intervene a month late. But they obviously are still interested in the outcome of this case as well. That is, to my knowledge, that the case, the request to build the LaSalle project that spawned their 206 complaint has not yet been wiped from the books. It still theoretically could be granted. But more importantly, this is something which, unlike everybody else in the industry, which will eventually have to deal with Order Number 1000, which is discussed in the briefs and which will be before this court before too long, we've been living with this ever since the first primary power order issued. So we have mayhem in the transmission planning process. We have cherry picking by people who aren't utilities yet but see a particularly valuable prospect open up and say, oh, you know, we'd like to build that. And utilities wanting to defend their turf saying, no, thank you. Those are our customers. That's our territory. And if there are going to be anybody charging cost-based rates for them, it'll be us. If you want to go defeat our state franchise, go to the New Jersey Board of Public Utility Control or the Pennsylvania Public Utilities Commission and ask them to revoke the franchise you've enjoyed for the last 100 years.
Is the same standing and rightness issue in play in the Order 1000 case?
I suppose this puts me in an awkward position of having to guess what FERC might argue. I do not think that FERC has had the audacity to raise standing and rightness in response to Order Number 1000. I should remember that since the other folks here worked on the Roper briefs in that case. But I do not believe that that is an issue, and it would be odd for it to have become one.
What's the difference between the two?
In this case, we have a declaratory order request by primary power to say under 205, what do the founding agreements of the PJM, what do the PJM's transmission owners agreement and the operating agreement, those are the two founding agreements that created PJM, what do they have to say with respect to construction rights? There was also the 206 complaint, which was denied as moot on the ground that the 205 issue had already been resolved. In Order Number 1000, FERC, subsequent to its initial order in this case, but prior to deciding rehearing, issued a broad rule that anyone who has a right of first refusal anywhere in a federal tariff has to remove it. So that's a 206 case. This is a 205 case. That is a global case, and this purports to be an interpretation of the PJM contracts at issue here.
Yeah, I guess as to standing and ripeness, I'm not sure I see a distinction based on the fact that one's global and one's case-specific. But I
don't think there's any question in this case that we have standing, that we've been injured by a contractual interpretation, and that this case is perfectly ripe for decision. Whether or not that will pop up in the Order Number 1000 case, we'll be discussing perhaps in a few weeks or months. So let's turn now, please, to FERC's lack of jurisdiction to reach the result that it has here. Ever since Atlantic City, Judge Sintel's opinion in Atlantic City issued, we in our industry have been talking about the Atlantic City doctrine, which is that FERC is a creature of statute, and RTOs only have those rights that we choose to give them when we join them under FPA Section 202. It is very clear in the PJM Transmission Owners Agreement and in the Operating Agreement that every right that was not specifically given to PJM was reserved by the PJM transmission owners. That has never been an issue in this case.
Now, that brings us then to the question of where does the pre-existing right of first refusal come from?
Your Honor,
you're saying you didn't give that up.
No, we didn't.
And my question to you is, where did you get it from in the first place?
Well, PJM is composed of 13 different states. Each of them have their own laws about how they form utility franchises. And the utilities have existed much longer than PJM has existed, whether as a power pool, which started considerably earlier, or later as an ISO, or then later as an RTO, as it's gone through these different permutations. The right to build in their territory is a franchise right, and just like a water utility company, electric utility company.
I'm going to interrupt you. I think you sort of answered my question.
Roger.
Now, if that pre-existing right does, as you say, come from state law, does this FERC action in this declaratory order case override that state law, or does the entity proposing to build the transmission still have to comply with whatever the state law is?
The entity is still going to have to comply with state law. The bad thing that FERC has done here is it's heavily influenced what is going to happen at the state level because of the filed rate doctrine and the trapped cost rules. It's essentially done what it can only do under Section 7 of the Natural Gas Act when it issues a Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity and says thou shalt build here and thou shalt not build here. It said,
the short part of the answer, though, is that they still, you still have whatever rights you previously had under state law.
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
Okay, thank you.
And we could not have given them up. One of the theories that FERC must be invoking in its contract interpretation.
You didn't give them up. I don't understand that. I'm saying we didn't.
And more is the point, so Your Honor, sure we couldn't have given them up.
I'm not sure what the thrust is of your argument that the contract did not take away from you any pre-existing right that you did not give up, if, in fact, you have not given that right up, if you still have that right under state law.
We still have the right under state law, so how...
You just said you did still have the right under state law.
We do.
Your argument earlier had been the contract does not take away, does not give the RTO any power over us that we didn't give it.
That's right.
Doesn't take away anything that we haven't given up.
That's right.
So everybody seems to be in agreement that you still have the same right you had before the
contract. We have the state right, but what FERC has purported to do is not only on its own, but to tell PJM that it can decide who gets to build things.
And then there will still have to be compliance with state law, right?
Yes, there's still that whoever wants to build something, once they've received their certificate from PJM, is going to have to go ask.
All that PJM can do, all the RTO can do, is to say it's all right with us if you do that.
Yes,
but you still have to go get the same approval under state law you did before we ever even approved Order 888.
That's correct, Your Honor. The term they use is designate, and they use designate for a reason. In the event, but the curious thing about the contract is that in the balance of agreements made upon the formation of the RTO, we agreed to give planning authority to PJM, and we agreed to build what it was that PJM designated. And when we did that, we were not in any way trying to offer up other opportunities for anyone else to invade any of our franchises. Let's turn, if we could, please, because I think I understand where you're coming from on the jurisdictional point.
I was not in the jurisdictional question. I was trying to get to merits at that point.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I thought you all had completed the jurisdictional part of it.
I guess I have. But mm-hmm. one will search in vain for anything in the federal power. I'm sorry.
If that makes it sound as if I think there is standing, you probably know that if I think there's standing, there's probably standing.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's reasonable to say. All right, time is short, so let's please turn then to the contractual interpretation issue. FERC wants to focus almost entirely on the operating agreement, which is an odd place to begin since the transmission owners agreement is what really creates the RTO in the first place. And I realize that it looks like there's a lot of hair on this ball, and why would you want to mess with it in G's? Wouldn't this be a safe place to turn to just defer to FERC's expertise? And this is, in fact, however, exactly not the case to do that in. Everything about FERC's case turns on, and I don't want to be pedantic and have to point to specific text, nor do I like to read, but please, everyone, as if we're in church, turn to page 475 of the Joint Appendix, and here is 1.5.73. That the PJM Board shall consider any new economic-based enhancements and expansions for inclusion in the Regional Transmission Plan, and for those enhancements or expansions it approves, the PJM Board shall designate, and here's the big ambiguity that FERC asserts, the entity or entities that will be responsible for constructing and owning or financing the additional economic-based enhancements or expansions, B, the estimated cost of such enhancements, and C, as is very important to us, the market participants that will bear responsibility for the cost of the additional economic-based enhancements and expansions pursuant to Section 1.5G of this Schedule 6. FERC wants to say that entity or entities here is somehow ambiguous. We have been telling them from the outset, no, we're not so stupid. When we created this organization, we weren't meaning to give other people rights to invade our territory. So we built this in. And what does Section 1.56G, the very sentence they're relying on, say? And it could not be more clear. Please roll back one page to Joint Appendix, page 473. The last sentence of that section, 1.5.6G, says, and it couldn't be clearer, look at the preamble. Notwithstanding the foregoing, so all gobbledygook in front of this, all FERC jargon aside, with respect to any facilities the Regional Transmission Expansion Plan designates to be owned by an entity other than the transmission owner, the plan shall designate that entity as responsible for the cost of such facilities. How does FERC escape this? FERC says, well, there'll be a transmission owner at the end of the process, so this is okay. They can charge cost-based rates. Now let's move to the immediate preceding page. What does 1.5.6F say? 1.5.6F says, and no one disputes, is the very top of the page. The recommended plan shall designate, this is that first top 2 lines, The recommended plan shall designate the transmission owner that owns transmission facilities located in the zone where the particular enhancement or expansion is to be located.
Mm-hmm.
No one disputes that we can't build in one of those territories. Met-Ed cannot build in PPL's territory, PSED can't build in Atlantic City, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No one ever disputes this. How does FERC escape the bar on construction? They say, well, that's okay because you're not a transmission owner yet. But, of course, they will become one, and the instant they become a transmission owner, this would apply to them and forbid them from doing exactly what they just done. It's an utterly irrational interpretation of the contract, and I haven't even gotten, because my time has now elapsed, into the problems with the with consolidated transmission owners.
So let me just ask you about this, because I think I agree with you that this language that you're pointing to in 1.5.6G on JA 473 is pivotal to your argument. And one thing that I wasn't clear on, and maybe there's an easy answer, is the clause that you're pointing to, the last sentence, says the plan shall designate that entity as responsible for the cost of such facilities. Does that necessarily mean that there will be no cost recovery? Or does it mean that, or is it at least possible
no,
that it meant?
It basically says thou shalt be a merchant. All right, you want to get this? Go to Barclays, go to Deutsche Bank, go to someone like that. Get an investor. You go build it, and if it's a valuable project, the market will pay for it. They'll do it through financial transmission rights. A generator will want to connect. Let's look at the two very successful merchant transmission providers in PJM, Linden VFT and Neptune. They observe that New York has a very large power demand, and that PJM has a whole lot of big coal plants. Well, at least until the EPA finishes with them. And they have a voracious appetite for power. So Neptune and Linden said, look, we can build these lines right across this water. They belong to no utility zone and sell massive amounts of power to New York. It's a very successful model. Just last week, this is a bit outside the record, but even these other examples, the RTOs all are very similar in this respect. New England Utilities is going to be building a new thing called the Northern Pass Line. They're building it through their territory in New England. But Hydro-Quebec is paying for it because Hydro-Quebec wants to sell a bunch of hydropower from Quebec to customers in New England. So what we're really fighting about here is, first, don't invade our territory, and don't pretend that you're not invading our territory when you say you're going to slap a synchronous condenser onto the immediate and adjacent foot. And second, don't add the insult that you're going to invade our territory and then tell us you're going to charge our own customers cost-based rates. Cost-based rates that we have to go fight with our utility regulators at the retail level every year or every two or three years to try to re-up.
I guess so I'm asking a little bit of a different question, but I think your answer addresses it, which is that the clause says the plan shall designate that entity as responsible for the cost of such facilities. And I guess what I'm wondering is it possible to read that language, and it sounds like you know because you were involved in the negotiations or at least represent entities that were, that deals not with whether cost can ultimately be recovered by end users in a cost recovery economic project sense, but rather it deals with allocation as among builders and transmission owners. So what it's saying is, in the first instance, the plan shall designate that entity, i.e. the third party, as responsible for the cost of such facilities. But it doesn't speak to whether that entity then can go about and get recoupment through cost recovery.
Ah, well, that, if you want more evidence on how that is covered, let's turn a little bit later to what you have in that situation is you have a market solution. 1.5.7J talks about this. That's on page 479. At any time, market participants may submit to the Office of Interconnection request to interconnect merchant facilities, generation facilities, Part 4, and in that event becomes a market solution. In the event of such designation, parts of the tariff, which are not in the joint appendix, would apply. And what that means is that you would have to then recover your rates in that manner. But there's a better place still for you to look for evidence of what this means, and that is the beginning of the Consolidated Transmission Owners Agreement. There are only two kinds of creatures you can be as a transmission owner in PJM. You can be a utility that controls a zone and charges cost-based rates to its customers, or you can be a merchant, or what is referred to in the Consolidated Transmission Owners Agreement as a zero revenue requirement entity. And that's it. Those are the only two species. We only have animal and plant here. We have no animal, plant, and mineral. And in the event that you are a zero requirements customer, the only way you can get any recovery is via market-based rates. It is crystal clear in the CTOA. Give me a moment, and I'll turn to the relevant provision. it's in the very definition of what a zero revenue requirement party is.
Okay, so you're saying that understanding precludes the
It precludes any understanding that anyone other than a and there's really no rational basis why it would operate in another way. Utilities have service obligations. Sometimes they have favorable projects. Sometimes they have unfavorable projects. But whether the project is to serve a new generator, which might be a really lucrative thing, or to build a line that's going to support low-income housing south of Philadelphia, they're going to get a common rate of return that's going to allow them to balance those obligations. Merchants see prime opportunities to go build something smart. They go do it. Banks fund it. And it gets paid for at market-based rates every time somebody has a transaction.
I know the answer to this is lurking in what you just said and also in the briefs. But how would you define economic project?
Oh, an economic project is one that is designed. It's not my definition. It's set forth in the tariff. An economic project is one that is designed to try to relieve a transmission constraint or to otherwise allow for more economic transportation energy. This is in contrast to a reliability project. Reliability projects are the more important ones, obviously, to build. Those are the lights on, lights off sorts of questions. But as this court, which in Black Oak and Sacramento and many other cases, has had to repeatedly discuss the components of locational marginal pricing, there's three components. The generation component, the congestion component, which means did we have to get something from a more expensive generator from a different transmission line, and then you have transmission line losses, which is just a function of physics. And a economic project would be one that's not strictly necessary to maintain reliability, but by solving some problem in delivery would make it much cheaper for everyone to get power.
And what is the defined relationship between being an economic project and the provider being able to charge cost-based rates?
Well, if it's a merchant and it comes up with a market solution, then it is going to recover its costs from the congestion price and perhaps also financial transmission rights, maybe auction revenue rights, depending on which RTO is involved in. If it is a cost-based utility, they're going to build it, and it's going to be the same rate no matter what. In fact, FERC likes to talk a lot about competition. The competition really exists not in who's going to build a facility by name, whether it's utility. Competition is between Siemens and Westinghouse and Black & Veatch and all the people who show up whenever a project's been picked and say, well, we can build it for this or we can build it for this. That's where the real competition in transmission lies. And it's why any notion that...
So the nomenclature of economic project does not necessarily imply a cost-based rate as opposed to a merchant rate.
No, Your Honor. If there was something
that
in the
briefing... It did seem at times in the briefing, perhaps not so much from you as from...
Well, I apologize if I inflicted any confusion on that.
From the commission that they, or maybe from you as well. I think from you as well, actually, that there seemed to be a link between this being an economic project and the use of the cost-based rate.
Here's the link, Your Honor. In its second set of orders, FERC said, oh, wait a second, we're not going to apply this to reliability-based projects. We're only going to do it for economic-based projects. So the reason why you see cost-based and economic together are because FERC took a step back and said, ooh, we might be going a little bit far by saying that other entities get to build your reliability projects, so why don't we just limit it to the economic ones? Now, in Order No. 1000, they've erased it entirely, which is another reason why this case is not Order No. 1000. But... at least under the existing rules now, we get to build reliability projects as long as we designate reliability projects to the extent they're economic projects, then we don't. Sorry for overstating.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't want to belabor this point, but I'd like to add one question to this chain of thought, which is there an inexorable connection between being a builder and getting cost-based recovery? In other words, there's two aspects to this case. One is, can a third party who's not an existing transmission owner be designated as the builder?
Right.
And the second is cost-based recovery possible?
Right.
And I read the briefs in somewhat a similar fashion, which is that they stand or fall together. And I'm wondering whether that's in fact true, because some of the language seems to suggest that you can be a third party and still be chosen to build. The particular clause you're focusing on deals not with that question, but with the question of cost recovery.
Right.
And so can you have a decoupling of those two things, or are they necessarily
standing under the contract? There's the one provision that we read that talks about who gets to build where, and we have the other provision that talks about how are you going to recover the costs.
Yeah.
All the stuff in front of the notwithstanding is how the cost-based rates are going to be calculated for the zonal guys. So there are two different violations of the contract. They do, in a sense, stand or fall together because, as we know, a merchant project can exist. They can go build something somewhere if the state allows them to do it, and they can sell things at cost-based rates. That's okay. There's not an antitrust aspect to this sort of agreement. There's also the question about cost-based rates. FERC can decide who gets or who does not get cost-based rates, but FERC can't decide who gets to build. So one of the reasons why the questions are separate is because for the purposes of jurisdiction, no one here is going to dispute that FERC gets to decide whether or not you get cost-based rates or what level of cost-based rates are going to be. But everyone on this side of the room is going to be disputing whether or not FERC gets to decide who builds in the first place. So that's the reason for the separation. From the standpoint of the contract, it's two different injuries. From the standpoint of the of jurisdiction, FERC's injury is really just on the who builds rather than the how much part. Does that answer your question, Your Honor's question?
Right. So you could have a rational state of the universe, then it sounds like, in which a third party can build, but as to the rate question, cost-based recovery isn't permissible. Or is that just not a rational state of the universe?
Could a merchant ever be given cost-based rates?
Right.
Well, you're going to be deciding that in order number 1,000, I guess. That doesn't need to be decided for the purpose of this case. The real only question, I think, before this court is, was the contract rationally decided and could FERC within its jurisdiction have reached the conclusion or enforced the conclusion that it purported to have come to? And the answer to both those questions is no. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lona Perry for the Commission. With regard to the initial issue of jurisdiction, the one thing that hasn't been discussed yet this morning that arose, the petitioner put the court on notice of this by virtue of a 28J letter to which we responded, was that this tariff language that was interpreted in these orders, the Commission has ordered it to be changed. And now the new tariff language that has been put in its place was effective as of January 1st, 2014. So in essence, in addition to the standing issues that we raised in the beginning, you have the issue now that the tariff language that you're being asked to interpret no longer exists.
But that's under review. Is that so?
No, it's under review. The thing is, Your Honor, the tariff language, in other words, the effect of the Commission order isn't stayed during appellate review unless the court, of course, issues a stay. And so the commission orders that require that this tariff language be changed have taken effect. The tariff language was changed effective as of January the 1st, 2014. So my point being that at this moment, issuing a decision on this tariff language is in effect an advisory opinion. And you have to consider the fact that until...
Wait a minute. What has been done that we're reviewing here would be undone by the change in the tariff language?
Yes, Your Honor, because the Commission ordered them to change the tariff language to remove any ambiguities
with respect to... That gets us going forward. I'm talking about what has already been done with respect to the zone an issue in this case.
And yes, Your Honor, my point is no one has ever been designated to build under this tariff language, and this tariff language has now been replaced. Mm-hmm. So there is no possibility of injury to the petitioners under this tariff language unless and until, at some point in the future, the currently existing tariff language is removed because of the appeal of Order 1000, and PJM reinstates this tariff language at some point
What's
in the future.
What's the schedule on that? Has that been briefed yet?
Yes, Your Honor. It has been briefed. It has not yet been set for oral argument.
Did FERC claim that the parties – who are the petitioners in that case?
There's a host of petitioners in that case, Your Honor. It includes the petitioners here, are nine separate sets of petitioner briefs.
Did FERC claim that those petitioners lack standing?
The commission said
a twofold question. Did FERC claim in its brief that they lacked standing or that the case wasn't right?
Only as to certain issues, Your Honor. There were certain issues that the commission made that argument with respect to, but not with respect to the rulemaking as a whole.
What about the right of first? I take it there's a right of first refusal question in that case as to whether FERC validly took action with respect to the right of first refusal that the petitioners say is embedded within their contracts.
And right.
Did you make the argument? This may be where Judge Randolph is going. Did you make the argument as you've made here that there's no standing in that case either?
No, we did not, Your Honor. And now, in that, Order 1000.
That frames my question better than I did, but that's exactly what I wanted to know.
We did not, Your Honor. In Order 1000, and which gives rise to the issue that I'm talking about here, in Order 1000, the Commission required people to change their tariffs to remove rights of first refusal, which is a different situation than what we're talking about here. But here they made
the
same.
But the argument would be the same, wouldn't it? I mean, they removed it, but the question, at least as far as rightness, that they can prove no current imminent injury because their ITO hasn't approved a non-incumbent project.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but you have to, even if you are dubious of the issue of standing as initially presented, you have to consider the fact now that the tariff language you're being asked to interpret no longer exists. And so there is no possibility until they get it reinstated at some point in the future, which is a very speculative proposition.
So if you prevail in the Order 1000 case, then this case is moot. That's your point.
There is one, not to be too complicated about this, there is one additional issue that has been raised. The petitioners have argued in the compliance filing for Order 1000 that this contract is protected by the Mobile Sierra Doctrine. And so even if Order 1000 is affirmed, this Mobile Sierra issue will not be resolved by the Order 1000 appeal. There will still be an issue about whether Mobile Sierra protected this contract or not. So at the end of that proceeding, assuming that the Commission prevails in both of those proceedings, which we certainly hope we will, then it would clearly be moved.
There's two separate proceedings going on right now, one with Order 1000 and one on the adjacent.
The Order 1000 compliance filing.
If I understand your point is that in the interim, before the decision in the Order 1000 case, that the petitioners suffer no harm because there's not been a stay, the language has been changed, and so there's nothing, no harm that they can, that we could do anything about.
Exactly, Your Honor, because nobody can be designated under this tariff language because it's been replaced. So there is no possibility that somebody is going to be designated under this tariff language which no longer exists. And it is only in the event, unless and until they succeed in getting it reinstated following all of these appellate proceedings, that there would actually be, it would be an advisory opinion at this point to consider this tariff language because it no longer is effective tariff language.
Can I just ask a technical question, which is if the commission loses in the Order 1000 case, then what has to happen in order to reinstate the pre-existing contract language, or does it just kind of reemerge of its own force since the replacement language would, by hypothesis, have been vacated by the commission's losing the Order 1000 case?
If the commission, heaven forbid, loses Order 1000, what would happen is the PJM, not the petitioners, they don't totally govern the tariff filings, but PJM would have to make a new filing to put in new tariff language. Because as of January 1st, 2014, the new tariff language is in effect, and it will be in effect until such time as something happens on appellate review.
The current language that we're dealing with here is forever gone. There's a possibility that it could be reinstated.
Exactly, Your Honor. Okay. But possibly, it could possibly repeat, but it would be subject to review at that time. There is no a problem with there being a future appellate review in the event that the tariff language is reinstated and someone, a primary power or a central transmission, again tries to build under the language, it could be addressed again at that time.
Except if I'm understanding correctly, there's still a Mobile Sierra issue, which is that, and if the on the Mobile Sierra one, you can't just say that the language is forever gone, because the whole point of the mobile city area question is whether the language ever should have, was validly taken away to begin with.
Yes, Your Honor, but the thing is, even if you, at the end of the appellate proceeding, even if you said, we're regarding this tariff language as having, as being backdated to the date of, to January 1st, 2014, the fact remains that no one will have been designated during that time period under that tariff language. Mm-hmm. So even if you deemed it to be backdated until January 1st, 2014, there's no risk that in the interim period, anybody is going to be designated to build under this tariff language. So that's why I'm saying there's no injury.
So should we hold this case in abeyance pending those other proceedings?
You can either hold it in abeyance pending those other proceedings, Your Honor, or you can deem it to be either premature because it's not ripe, because there's no good reason to decide it now, and there is no injury to the petitioner from waiting until later. You can regard it as being moot because this is an advisory opinion, essentially, at this point, and it's capable of repetition but would not evade review. You could regard it as again, as a question of standing, that at this particular point, they can't be injured by this interpretation of the tariff language because the tariff language has been replaced. And it's not, there is no prospect of injury unless and until you get to that point where the tariff language is again reinstated.
If we dismiss... Then you lost in the Order 1000 case. When would the petitioners have an opportunity to mount the arguments against the decision of FERC in this case?
Well, in the first place, there would be a tariff filing by PJM to reinstate the language, assuming that that's what PJM decided to do at the conclusion of all these proceedings.
And I take it that would encompass the interpretation of that language that FERC put forward in this case, which the petitioners object to. So when, at what point and what type of proceeding would the petitioners have an opportunity to mount the objections that they mounted in this case?
Well, they can mount the objections in the same manner that they did here in the event that anybody attempts, any non-incumbent utility attempts to build under the cost of service provisions for economic projects.
And FERC... Would FERC claim that they were collaterally estopped from challenging the interpretation that was put forward in this case?
Your Honor, now that this is before this court, the court would have to would be issuing an order that would say either it's not ripe or it's moot or they're lacking standing at this time because of this issue with the tariff. But under any circumstances, there's going to be no basis on which we can claim collateral estoppel because the court is going to say it's premature or it's moot or because of the current situation. And there's we'll have no basis for claiming collateral estoppel down the road.
So you wouldn't be able to claim that. That's your position?
Not if this court rules that the case is premature or that it's moot at this time because it would be an advisory opinion and there's no extant tariff language to interpret. I don't see any basis on which we could claim collateral estoppel down the road.
Or that it's a collateral challenge. I mean, I think that we're sort of mixing the two, but I think the point
was
being made earlier.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, that it's a collateral attack, not collateral estoppel.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's a collateral attack, yeah.
I am happy to discuss the merits of the tariff review if...
Well, you raised some questions about whether we should go there, but since you're here, I do have one question about the merits, which is the question that we were addressing earlier, which is do the question of who builds and whether cost-based recovery is permissible necessarily stand or fall together in your view, or is there possibly a decoupling such that the way to construe the tariff is that third parties can build... But by virtue of the language that Mr. Shepard points to, cost-based recovery is impermissible.
The thing to keep in mind, Your Honor, about this is there actually isn't any issue about whether these projects could be built in their territory as merchant projects. So the question in this case actually really has nothing to do with whether people can build in their territory. I mean, if you look Actually, they talk about this in their brief at page 22, and also in their protests in the central transmission proceeding. These projects could have been built as merchant projects in their territories, right? It's not actually their territories, but in the territory of utilities. So it's not really an issue about whether it's getting built. It's an issue whether you can get cost recovery. And if it was built as a merchant project, it would be under 1.5.7J, which allows for market solutions for merchant projects. But if you want cost recovery, you must come under the terms of 1.5.7C3. And that's where this whole issue comes from, is whether the people who could build as merchant projects can get cost recovery by building under 1.5.7C3. And so it's really just a question of cost recovery, what cost recovery they're entitled to in building these projects.
So all the language that you've pointed to in your order that encompasses beyond transmission owners and gets to entities, all that language raises an ambiguity in your view, but that ambiguity all goes to ultimately to the question of cost recovery. There's not a question in and of itself of whether those entities can build, third-party entities can build. Because what you're saying is that question is kind of beside the point. Really, that question only goes to the question of whether those third parties can get cost-based recovery.
It's what kind of cost recovery they can get for the projects that they are entitled under the tariff to build. So, yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Any further questions? Thank you.
So, Mr. Shepard, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And maybe you could start
first
by,
to turn to yeah. Sorry, Your Honor.
Can you comment on the argument that's being made about the interaction between this
and
the Order
exactly.
1000 case?
And I think the answer is fairly simple. Yes, they can recover costs, but they cannot recover costs from the utilities customers in the area they're building.
Well, what does that? I guess my question is about the pendency of the Order 1000 proceeding.
Oh,
the argument that's being made by FERC
I thought your last question was about the rates question.
No, this is about whether we should go forward with the decision in the case, given
this
that
one?
the tariff language, according to FERC, is no longer in existence.
I'm finding it difficult to not get very upset because I'm not sure what universe I have been transported to where, because FERC says...
Overcome it and answer the question.
That we have been directed to remove something from our contract. It will not be replaced by a pure PJM filing because it is a contract that we are a party of, although PJM might be the vehicle for signing it. The compliance filing that was made is expressly built in that we're being told that we have to do this subject to the outcome of the Order Number 1000 proceeding. I am not aware of any doctrine ever, and Judge Srinivasan, one of your questions, and Judge Randolph, one of your questions went to this point, that because FERC has declared that the tariff is removed, that it is now removed for all time and is going to become our burden to put it back in, even if we prevail in the Order Number 1000 case. That is just an alien law to me under common law. I don't know what it means, and I'm not familiar with that argument. I don't even have words to express how alien it is to the mode of thinking that I've approached.
Well, what do you think happens if you do prevail in the Order 1000 case?
All right. And, I mean, as it interacts here?
Yeah.
If we prevail in the Order Number 1000 case, then FERC has no authority under Section 206 to eliminate wholesale all right of first refusals contained in all RTO tariffs or other public utility tariffs anywhere in the country.
But I think her point is that if you prevail, the language that we're talking about now
is gone. If we prevail in the Order Number 1000 case, we're still up for the contract interpretation in this case that says we don't have a right of first refusal. So we have to win Order Number 1000 and we have to win this case. It doesn't do us any good to win Order Number 1000 on its own so long as the orders here stand, because the orders here tell us that bizarrely, we've agreed in our founding documents that we're going to allow these other people to...
But I think the question is whether the language that we're dealing with here continues to exist, because I think the point that she was making is that language is gone. PJM might reinstate it.
And I'm protesting that and saying, Your Honor, I am not aware of any doctrine that says just because FERC told us in a compliance filing it wants us to make that language go away, that we then have the burden of reinstating that language until we've been able to litigate that to review.
Has the language been replaced?
The language
as of January 1st, 2014?
I believe the answer to that question is yes. And the language, and we could provide it in a 28-J letter if you wish.
Why does that not moot this action to interpret that language?
Because it says subject to the outcome of the Order No. 1000 proceeding. We don't agree that it should have been removed. And as alluded to earlier, this is one of three potential cases you're going to hear on this subject. There's this case. This was the first. Then we have Order No. 1000, which took the rule from primary power and exported it.
Decide right now.
Right. I'm just letting you know what's headed.
And you're asking us to construe this language.
Yes.
In this action, we can't do anything about the authority of FERC to supersede it in the way in which it's been litigated in the Order 1000 proceedings, can we?
Your Honor, I do not believe that you can assume for purposes of deciding this case that FERC has already won Order No. 1000 and already won its Order No. 1000 compliance mandate. That
so
case is
now,
not
then,
final.
So for now, why isn't FERC correct that this is either moot or unright?
We have additional injuries that expand beyond the tariff language, namely that since, unlike everyone else in the country, we've been living with this since primary power order first issued, our planning process has been causing us continuing injury no matter what, regardless of what the tariff language says. But again, I don't know how else to return to this except to say the tariff language was removed at FERC's direction in an action that we protested, which is subject to judicial review.
Let me ask you this question. If FERC prevails in the Order 1000 case, then this case is inconsequential. Is there at least common ground on that?
FERC prevails in the Order No. 1000 case on the ROFR issue because there are nine separate issues, and this court holds that they have authority under 206 to eliminate rights of first refusal, then this case will matter.
This case doesn't matter.
This case will not matter.
So the only hypothetical scenario in which this case does matter is if FERC doesn't prevail and you prevail. I guess where we are is there's a disagreement between the two sides in this case on what happens in that event. FERC thinks that the language is gone, and there would have to be subsequent action to reinstate it. You say that you disagree with that.
Of course that's false.
You disagree with that.
An agency issues a command. They tell you to do or not do something, whether it's in a tariff or not in a tariff. It could be just any kind of bold command. We litigate it, and the court reverses. We don't have to go ask for the right to do it again at the end of the day. I don't even know what that means. I don't know where that comes from.
Well, you can ask for that relief in the Order 1000 case. I mean, that might be a separate section of the brief.
Which relief, Your Honor?
Relief that the status quo ante is restored.
Is restored? Well, I suppose, but I don't think that would be necessary. I have the Order No. 1000 briefs, by the way, here to confirm what Ms. Perry suspected they did not argue about.
But if we construe this language and you lose the Order 1000 case, we have entered an advisory opinion at that point, haven't we?
Well, certainly not for the interim between the two decisions, also not for of the projects.
Whoa. Between the two decisions, this language is not in effect. Is that not correct?
Not in effect. I disagree with that premise, Your Honor.
FERC says it's gone.
FERC says it's gone, and I say it's not gone until this court affirms their orders in a final.
That takes us back in a circle back to Order 1000. In the meantime, if we decide to construe this language, and eventually you lose the Order 1000 proceeding, then we've entered an advisory opinion, haven't we?
If you're contemplating issuing it first, how could it possibly be advisory before then? I guess that's why I'm troubled by the premise of the question.
At least that this language is not effective during the interim.
Is
now,
an opinion that
what effect does this language have during the pendency of the Order 1000 proceeding? What is the effect of this language? Why isn't FERC
language
that it's gone for the time being?
FERC's wrong. It's not gone. They're
wrong, but what effect does it have? I'm asking you why they're
But wrong. What's the language? The language that's not there or the language that FERC asks us to insert?
To construe in this case.
Yes.
FERC says it's gone.
Okay.
They've ordered it up. Now, you're saying they didn't validly do that, but that's under litigation in the other case. In the meantime, what effect does that language have that FERC has ordered you to take it, to order PJM to take up?
That language, and I think if I'm understanding your question correctly, I'm to presume that it continues to exist. It gives us the right to not have 17 different people apply for the Artificial Island Transmission Project. It allows us to not have to put in a whole new pile of new cost of service data every time we want to do something at PJM. I have no idea when this case, when this court is going to decide Order on 1000. I have no idea how, although I do have my opinions about how it should be decided. But I don't think it's possible for a case which is where we have standing now, and the case is ripe for decision now. Even if a later case makes this decision no longer matter, it doesn't make it advisory now. It's
I'm
real
asking
now.
Also if it's moot.
No.
Because FERC is saying that this language is no more.
No, and I'm struggling to find
and
any.
And until FERC is reversed by this court, FERC has the right to say that. So right now, you're telling me about 17 other people might apply for a project. Is that really before us, what 17 other people might do? Right now, FERC has stricken that language. You may win, you may get them overturned in Order 1000, in the Order 1000 proceedings, but for right now, why isn't this a moot question? It may become alive again someday. But.
Because if the Order Number 1000, if they lose in Order Number 1000 and the language is reinstated, then presumably
then
the orders here that will have construed that language will go back into effect because it will be the same language that goes back into effect. This is an interpretation about language as it exists right now. If it disappears because FERC said go away, and then it reappears because Order Number 1000 is overturned, then we've got the same language and the same orders interpreting the same language, and they're still just as wrong in the future when they retain new vitality than they were when they were issued in the first place.
I mean, I guess one way to ask the question is, what happens in the interim until this court decides the Order 1000 case? So in that period, FERC says this language is gone. Now, suppose some other proposal comes along, and I may be getting the terminology wrong, so forgive me. But suppose some other proposal comes along in the interim period.
There are like 300 proposals.
Okay, so those proposals are in the pipeline right now. Are those proposals in the pipeline governed by the language that FERC now says is gone and that you're asking us to review in this case? Or is it governed by the replacement language in this interim period?
We have been living, because it's very similar to the Order Number 1000, we have been living in the primary power regime since the first primary power order issued. So we already live in the world where that language has been erased. We live in that world right now, right? Because they said that it doesn't mean what we say it means. Then later on, they ordered it be removed as what? Belt and suspenders? We pointed out in a 28J letter how crazy it is for FERC to tell us, well, you know, this language doesn't really mean this, but then later tell us in a compliance filing, but you better remove it because someone, without the benefit of reading our orders, might interpret it.
I think we understand that you're raising a question about the pre-new language regime, and
right,
that we've got that issue before us now.
Okay.
But I guess my question is still, so put that to one side for now.
Okay.
FERC comes along and says, you have to excise this language in your contract/tariffs.
Okay.
Here's the new language you've got to put in. In all these projects that are now in the pipeline, these proposals that are in the pipeline, until this court resolves the validity of Order 1000 against the challenge that you're raising in that case, what language is governing the resolution of those proposals?
We are living in a primary power world. We are living in the world where we are presently aggrieved by the primary power orders. So in essence, the language that they're saying that doesn't matter because they've removed it, we're already living in a world where we're questioning the removal of that language and what it means to us. So I hope that answer is
I don't think it does.
You can go ahead.
Maybe you could try to. I mean, I don't think it answers my question, and maybe I'm not asking the right question.
Didn't even approach the question.
Okay. My question is, those proposals, there's going to be some resolution as to those proposals.
Right. PJM makes designations on
forget that primary power was ever decided.
Yeah. All right.
Does the language in the old PJM agreement govern, or does the language that FERC ordered inserted govern new proposals in the interim?
Primary power governs.
Forget primary power.
I don't know how to do that.
Well, I guess
you have two sets of contractual language.
Right.
You have what we're being asked to construe here. You ask
That's one.
Two is what FERC has ordered inserted in place of that. Now, primary power has never been decided. You're just looking at this with new applicants, new proposals.
Okay.
Does language one govern, or does language two govern?
for someone who proposes something, say, right now?
Yeah.
After January 1st?
Yes. We're getting there.
Okay. I'm sorry to have been so dense. That will depend on the outcome of this case and on an order number 1000. If we are...
For right now, anybody who proposes something in February
of this year mm-hmm. is, I guess, entitled to rely on the tariff as it exists at the time, as long as we understand the caveat that could be overturned.
In other words, FERC's language governs right now.
I guess. I would not want to be the transmission developer who builds under that regime and get subject to a refund liability that's going to
take back.
I didn't
ask you that.
No,
Mr.
I'm just...
Boston didn't ask you that.
That's right. You did.
So FERC's language governs for these...
FERC's language governs for right now.
Yeah.
In which case, then everything stands or falls on the resolution of the Order 1000 case. Because if the Order 1000 case results in the win for FERC, then this set of issues just seems like it goes away forever.
No, Your Honor, because we have been injured and continue to have been injured since the origination of the initial order. What do we say about the projects that were proposed at all times prior to January 1st, 2014, now, right? Those also have a life of their own. Were those things correctly or were they incorrectly designated? We don't know what that is. We don't know if we had to turn those things in. We've already lived with these injuries in terms of the planning process. They're past injuries, but they were real. And if someone wants to claim, as Primary Power did, that they sought designation for some project prior to January 1st, 2014, then I don't know what it is that we're supposed to say to them. They're going to rest on Primary Power, and that's what's governing all times prior to 2014. But it is certainly an odd world to live in, where by the accidents of FERC controlling its own rehearing calendar, we have to live with a situation like this. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted.